Emotions Matter, brought to you by EMAW.com. That's EMAWW.com, your solution for emotional intelligence. We're excited to have Jake Eagle as our guest on this episode of the Emotions Matter podcast. Jake has been a licensed practicing psychotherapist for more than 25 years and is the author of the award-winning book, Get Weird: How to Make the Most of Your Life. Jake refers to his current practice as conscious mentoring. Jake and his wife, Hannah, host the highly acclaimed Live Conscious retreats several times a year. Jake, it's a real pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great. Good stuff. So let's start by giving our listeners some perspective of your previous life as a psychotherapist and how you've done a metamorphosis into your life today.
Well, I have been a psychotherapist for 25 years. I had a practice in Santa Fe. And then in the last 15 years, my wife and I started teaching retreats where people would come for 6, 7, 8 days on an intensive. We continue to do that work. But about a year ago, we moved. We moved to Hawaii and we stopped to reevaluate the work we've been doing with people. And what we recognized is that most of the people who come to our programs or people who came to me for private counseling, they're actually very fortunate people. They have a great deal of choice and freedom in their lives, but they were overly preoccupied on their problems. And my concern was that I think many forms of therapy actually encourage people to focus on their problems, to be what I call somewhat self-indulgent, and to not recognize how really extraordinary their lives are. And so when we made the move, we started to shift the way we work. And our focus today is, it's very much captured in the name of our website and our model, which is Live Conscious. We're encouraging people to live consciously, to do everything consciously, speak consciously, relate consciously, eat consciously, and to really recognize the amount of choices that we have as we go through our days. And this has shifted the work in a way that for me has been very exciting in the last few months.
Really, what it sounds like is you're taking a more positive approach to the therapy than starting with the negative.
It is more positive. And even when I was in private practice, my approach was generally what's called outcome-oriented. In other words, we were generally looking towards the future and what can you do as opposed to looking back and trying to figure out why you are the way you are. But even then, there is still this interesting dynamic in therapy where people talk about their problems, and simply by listening and engaging, I think what we're doing is we're encouraging them to overemphasize the challenges and the problems they have in their lives. And so, yes, this is a more positive approach, but it's not just simply being positive. It's getting people to approach the challenges in their life from a different state of consciousness.
I understand that the mentors for your current practice were John and Joyce Weir. What would you say was the basis of what you learned from them?
Yeah, so the Weirs are a fascinating couple. When we met them, they were 85 years old, and they actually had been pioneers in the human potential movement back in the 1960s. That's when people like Carl Rogers were very active and many others. And John and Joyce developed a fascinating approach to working with people, and it's based on the following idea. The idea is this: nothing means anything other than the meaning that you give it. So nothing means anything other than the meaning you give it. Now, a lot of people listening may nod their head and they go, well, yeah, I kind of get that idea that we have different perceptions. We have different ways of interpreting things. Mm-hmm. So people can accept that. But what John and Joyce did is they created a language that made it obvious that that is actually what's happening. In other words, oftentimes when people are relating with other people, they will blame another person for how they feel. Like I might say to you, you made me angry, or you're making me upset. Mm-hmm. And what the Weirs did is they created a language called percept or perception language. And I would say things differently. I would say, I'm angering myself, or I'm frustrating myself. And so the point is, I'm taking ownership for how I feel instead of blaming other people. Mm. So tie that back to the idea, nothing means anything other than the meaning you give it. Mm. So let's say that you and I have, we have an agreement. We're going to meet at 7 o'clock and you show up and it's 7:15. And so I can give that whatever meaning I choose to give it, but I don't have to act as if you have done something to me, that you have treated me poorly. Mm-hmm. But that's typically how people do act.
Right. So in the past, I've been in some therapeutic conversations from a communications perspective between another person. I was taught to, rather than you made me feel this way, it was the intent for me to just say, I'm feeling this way. Is that sort of the idea? It was.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's going in the right direction. The what's left out in that statement, I'm feeling, is, well, who made you feel that way? So it's still nebulous. It's still open for interpretation. Mm-hmm. Where if I say I'm making myself feel blank, I'm taking complete responsibility for my emotional life.
Gotcha. So it's I'm taking ownership of the way I feel, whereas in the previous conversations I was having, it was more of an engagement to have a conversation with someone. The way that I was taught was basically when I was a manager and I was having to communicate with a staff member about something they had done right or something they had done wrong. That was the sort of communication that we were trying to learn how to deliver.
I think it's great. I mean, it's a step in the right direction as opposed to holding someone else responsible for how you feel. Mm-hmm. I think it's great to say, this is how I'm feeling. And then our work, which is based on what the Weirs created, John and Joyce Weir, it goes even further where I say, I am doing this to myself.
Mm-hmm. So it's a basis of language. And so for the benefit of our audience, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you call perception language or percept.
Right. And that's exactly what the Weirs created, which is a way of speaking that does several things. It allows me to take ownership for how I create meaning. It allows me to take ownership for my feelings. And it also brings me into the present. So for example, one of the things we do when we use perception language is we don't spend a lot of time arguing about our different memories or perceptions of something that happened in the past. What we do is we talk about what we need or want right now in this moment. Mm-hmm. So again, let's go back and say you and I had an interaction and for some reason, you know, we're unhappy with one another. One of us feels the other one didn't live up to an expectation. Mm-hmm. There's a real tendency for people to say, well, last Thursday, you told me you were going to X, Y, and Z. And then you come back and say, well, no, actually, that's not what I said. What we're doing is we're saying to people, drop that. Just tell me, what do you need right now? I mean, literally right now in this moment, what is it that you need from me so we can move forward? Or what is it that you need to say to me? And what Hannah and I found, my wife, Hannah and I found in the last 15 years since we learned this, is that we have, I can't even tell you how rare it is that we argue over things anymore. Mm-hmm. Because we're not disputing one another's version of reality. You know, she can say, I asked you to take the car in and get it fixed, and you said you would do it, and you haven't done it. Mm-hmm. I don't argue and say, no, you didn't ask me. I believe her, right? Right? I mean, we may have a different memory, but I believe that what she tells me is what she believes.
Let's talk a little bit about consciousness then, because it sounds to me like you've made some very conscious choices in the way that you communicate both with your wife and how you're able to mentor other people. So if we talk about stimulating a higher consciousness, is perception language kind of a part of that?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the ways we do it. What we've done is we've created a very simple model, and we're saying that there's essentially three different degrees of consciousness. And you could say there's 10 or you could say there's 100, but for the sake of this model, we've identified three. The first level of consciousness is safety consciousness. And that's where we live most of the time. It's about being productive. It's about taking care of business. It's about making sure that we do the things we said we were going to do. It's about creating emotional boundaries. And this is the vast majority of our lives. Then there's another degree of consciousness, which we call heart consciousness. And there are certain practices that will help me shift into heart consciousness. When I do that, I am no longer viewing things in the same way. I'm coming at everything from a different perspective with a different attitude. And what may have been a problem in safety consciousness often is no longer a problem once I am into a state of heart consciousness. And I'll give you an example in a minute. And then beyond heart consciousness is something called spacious consciousness. And that is a state of, it's a contemplative state that we arrive in through meditation. And when we do that, we have a great sense of expansion, mm-hmm. a great sense of timelessness. And we stop feeling the anxiety and the pressure and the overwhelm that seems to be like an epidemic these days. So if we go back to the idea of safety consciousness and heart consciousness, and you asked the question, you said, how does perception language fit into this? Perception language is designed to help me when I'm in safety consciousness. Perception language is a way to communicate with other people where I empower myself and I have a sense of greater control in my emotional life. And as soon as I do that, it improves the quality of my relationships and my own experience. So that's how we bring perception language into safety consciousness. Once we move to heart consciousness, it's interesting. It's a less verbal plane. It's not that we don't talk and communicate, but it's more having to do with a state of being than doing.
So Jake, let me ask you a question about, say you're in an emotional relationship, you're in a relationship. Is there a way that perception language actually helps drive or enhance that relationship and the consciousness of both of the individuals within the relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use myself as an example. Hannah and I have been married for 25 years, and so we had 10 years where we were together before we knew this language. And I think we were a pretty healthy couple at the time. We'd both done some therapy. We had pretty good communication skills. But after we learned to use perception language, our whole relationship changed. And the change is that it became easy. And the reason it became easy is that, for one thing, we stopped telling one another. I stopped telling her about her, and she stopped telling me about me. Mm-hmm. We learned to do something that we call witnessing. Mm-hmm. And witnessing is basically taking the time to try to understand another person's experience. Doesn't mean that you agree with it. Doesn't mean that you even validate it. But you take the time to really try and understand what it's like for them. And what we found is that that is not a dialogue. In other words, it's not a back and forth, mm-hmm. particularly if one of the two people is upset or if both of the people are upset. The person who's the most upset, the way we do this, is the one who's the most upset speaks first. Mm-hmm. And you basically talk until you feel that you've said what you have to say, and the other person's job is simply to try to understand. What I think then happens is the mistake is then you switch roles. Mm-hmm. But I think we do it too quickly. And what's more helpful is just one person speak, the other person takes the time to witness, and then you take a break. And that break could be 15 minutes or it could be a day before you come back and the other person has a chance to say, well, this is what it's like for me. Mm-hmm. And this is what I mean when I talk about witnessing. The other part of perception language that's so valuable for people in relationship is that when we're talking, if I'm talking to you, John, I would make clear that what I'm telling you is only what's going on in my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm not telling you about you. I'm telling you what I'm doing in my mind so that you can better understand me. It's not a statement about you.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So as this audience will be considering specific actions, which may evoke the emotion of love, talk to us about living and loving consciously.
Well, the most interesting thing to me about living and loving consciously, particularly loving, is that when I try to love someone and express my love, but I'm coming from a place of safety consciousness, it's not a clean communication. Mm-hmm. Because really, I have an agenda. I'm trying to do things to accomplish an outcome or make myself feel safe or get something done. But if I really want to have a loving interaction with someone, that's the point of coming from a place of heart consciousness. And when I go to heart consciousness, what happens is I do experience love, but it's not love that's dependent on another person. It's love of life. It's love of the positive things I have in my life. It's love of being able to walk and talk and see the beauty that surrounds me. None of this is dependent on another person. Mm-hmm. And when I embody this quality of love that emanates from within me, I'm less needy when I have a relationship and I'm not looking for the other person to have this experience of love. So to me, this is a very different way to think about particularly romantic relationships where I'm not dependent on the other person for my sense of love.
Let me try to put that in, you know, in terms for myself. If I'm in a relationship and I have the need for some stimulation, like mental stimulation from that person to believe that I feel loved by them, what is the approach of the consciousness for me? How do I get into that state of mind? It sounds to me like it's more of just an awareness, an appreciation of what's happening in my life or about me versus dependent on that other person.
Yeah, I mean, you said it really well. It's exactly what it is. It's an awareness that you hold within yourself of your life and being grateful for the things that you have. I mean, the question that I ask people nowadays is, are you thrilled when you wake up in the morning? Mm-hmm. And what people say to me all the time is they go, well, you know, I feel fortunate. Or they say, well, I'm pleased. But very few people respond by saying, yeah, I'm thrilled. And yet think about it in terms of your own life. I mean, when you wake up in the morning, do you feel thrilled to be alive, to have the life you have?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll have to say that as I've managed to make it through this life, I have consciously, when people say, how are you doing, John? I always say, I'm great, versus, you know, a lot of times you'll hear someone say, you know, it's an okay day, or, you know, I woke up breathing, it should be okay, or whatever, you know, something very trite. I always believe that in response to someone, you really do want to express your appreciation for what you do have. So, yeah, I'm feeling great. And it's interesting the responses you get from people, because they don't expect that. They don't expect you to really have that much of a positive approach to a response about you and your life.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that we invite people to complain. We invite people to tell us that they're unhappy, they're struggling, they're suffering. And of course, I'm not trying to minimize when somebody really is struggling with something, that needs to be acknowledged too. But my concern is that often we're not really, let me put it this way, often our suffering is unnecessary, mm-hmm. right? There's a great quote from the philosopher Martin Heidegger, and the quote is the following. He says, in the state of mindfulness of being, one marvels not about the way things are, but that they are. Mm-hmm. So he's saying we're marveling at just the very fact that we're alive, that in and of itself is inspiring and exciting and wonderful. And I don't mean to suggest that makes everything okay, but when I approach my life with that perspective, it changes the way I see everything.
Mm-hmm. So the intent then is to be much more aware of the good things, the goodness, the positive aspects of your life.
I would say two things. The intent is to be more aware, yes, and more aware of the good things when that's possible. There are times when it's totally appropriate to be in safety consciousness and concerned or preoccupied. The question to ask is, what state of consciousness am I in first? And is that the state of consciousness I want to be in? Mm-hmm. And this is where I think people make a mistake. So, for example, I'll work with couples a lot, and sometimes they'll want to sit down and have a talk to take their relationship to the next level. And whether they sit down to have that conversation in safety consciousness or they sit down to have that conversation in heart consciousness will create a completely different outcome.
So do you feel that there is, as you're working through these couples, does there tend to be a difference in your approach to men versus women?
Yeah, I think that generally with men, my approach is a little bit more confrontive. It's a little bit more pointing out what I often see as their immaturity. Yeah. I see less of that in women. Doesn't mean that women are never immature, but I see it's a real theme with men that they have a hesitation to step up, step into their adult role, take responsibility, express themselves in a mature way. And so that's a big focus when I work with men and I'm doing couples therapy, and less of that when I'm working with women. When I'm working with women, I think it's a little bit more about helping them empower themselves. It's not that they lack maturity for the most part, but sometimes they hold themselves back.
Gotcha. Interesting. Well, you mentioned it a little earlier, but diving just a little deeper into relationships. So you and Hannah have been married since 1993 and have been doing retreats together for 15 of those years. What can you share with our audience about the language that you use with each other, and how has it provided for such a successful partnership?
Well, I think there are a few things. The first one is that when there are times of tension or conflict, we slow way down. We slow down and we become much more intentional. And that's when we really use perception language the most. And that's where we go out of our way to remind one another. I'll say, hey, Hannah, I'm just talking about me. I don't know that this is even accurate, but this is my perception of what's going on. And that really allows her to hear my experience as opposed to when she thinks I'm talking about her. So that's one thing. Another is that when there's tension or conflict, one of us almost always has the wherewithal to ask the following question. What do you want to have happen in the next 5 minutes? In other words, do you want to connect or do you want to fight? Right? It's a great question. What do you want to have happen in the next 5 minutes? And 90% of the time we answer that by saying we both want to connect. Now, you know, once in a rare while, one of us just wants to fight, but that actually hasn't happened for quite a long time. Yeah. So those are things that we do when times are challenging or when there's, as I say, when there's tension, when things are going well. What we do more than anything else is, as I said before, we take the time to witness one another, to really pay attention to the other person. And to do that requires slowing down.
Well, yeah. That sounds like a good plan, because I do believe a lot of times when you get into a conversation, if it be a problematic conversation or heated conversation, things tend to speed up, and that tends to make things happen that are not necessarily, you do or you say things that aren't necessarily the things that you really want to come out of the conversation.
Exactly right. There's a saying from Viktor Frankl, which is that in the space between the stimulus and the response is our power and freedom to choose. So you have the stimulus, somebody says something to you, and if you respond immediately, there's not a lot of choice, right? But if we slow down and we think about what would be helpful, what would be constructive, what would be kind, we're probably going to have a very different response. And one of our beliefs, a lot of people don't think this, but we believe that anything can be said in two ways. Anything can be said in a kind way or not. There's nothing that I can't say to you in a kind way. I believe that. So why wouldn't I do it in a kind way?
That's a great practice. Something definitely to keep people thinking about. Because yes, absolutely, your responses have all to do with the next, you know, step is going to be in that conversation, and to be able to respond kindly without being hateful or whatever is definitely the approach to take.
Now this goes,
and that was going to take a lot of practice, isn't it?
Well, that's a great question, because I actually think it's a mistake to think it will. In other words, I know that. I hear that all the time. Clients will say, this is hard, it's going to be difficult. But what I see in the couples that are successful is they learn about this stuff and they make changes really quickly. And this has to do with a fascinating thing, which is we have a course called Dating, Relating, and Mating. And in that course, one of the things we teach is the value of intolerance. Now, that sounds politically incorrect, but my point is that we, Hannah and I, are intolerant of being treated poorly. We're intolerant of being treated disrespectfully. We're intolerant of emotional pain. I mean, for example, years ago, this hasn't happened for a long time, but years ago, she and I had a difficult argument. Within a day, if it hadn't been resolved, we would call our therapist and go and get help, because we couldn't tolerate being disconnected and in pain.
Wow.
So I think that not tolerating these things is really helpful. And your comment about, well, probably takes a lot of practice, it's along the same lines. If we're intolerant, maybe it doesn't take a lot of practice. Maybe we just say, you know what? I'm not going to speak to you that way again. Mm-hmm. That's it. I'm done. And I think that when people make that kind of earnest commitment to change their behavior, they can actually change it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, certainly something that I think many of us are going to want to take the proactive measures to start doing sort of some of those things and maybe improve our relationships. And actually, it's not maybe. For sure, we'll improve our relationships and our conversations.
Yeah, so, that's right.
So let's take a little different tack. We do have one of our listeners has written in for a little guidance, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Sandy is a 42-year-old mother of two who lives in Seattle and has recently been diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. She tells us that she hasn't discussed it with her family yet and is actually having difficulty with her own realization. She asks, how do I mentally prepare myself for what's next and be able to communicate with my loved ones about this?
Great question. Great. Yeah, let's talk about this a little bit. So any illness or any seriously challenging situation like this is best dealt with from a place of feeling resourceful and knowing that you have choices. Now, when we have a serious medical diagnosis, oftentimes we feel like we don't have choices and our resources feel like they're drained away. So it's really important to get back in touch with the fact that we do have choices and that we want to approach this from it goes back to our conversation earlier, John, we want to approach it from a different consciousness instead of a fear consciousness. Mm-hmm. There's some great research around people that have serious diagnosis, particularly terminal diagnosis. And it goes like this, that the first response they have to the diagnosis, if it's one of denial, that actually can be very constructive. It can allow them to make difficult decisions and choices. But reasonably soon, they need to shift into a response not of being in denial, but of expressing their feelings. Mm-hmm. And so I think this relates to the question. Very important to share the experience, to share your feelings, to let other people share their feelings. And it's also a risky thing when you decide for other people what they can and can't handle. Mm-hmm. Because when that happens, then you're taking on too much responsibility. And in this case, you know, Sandy's already got enough on her plate. To take on the responsibility of what other people can or can't handle is a lot. Mm-hmm. The second reason to share with other people is because if you don't, it deprives them of having their own experience, whatever that may be. So this is what I would say to Sandy. This is my favorite quote. It comes from Rollo May. And what he said was the following. He said, "Does not the uncertainty of our time teach us the most important lesson of all? That the ultimate criteria are the honesty, integrity, courage, and love of any given moment of relatedness. If we do not have that, we're not building for the future anyway. And if we do have it, then we can trust the future to itself." Now, what he meant was, in any situation of uncertainty, and Sandy's dealing with a situation with some uncertainty, if she relates to people with honesty, integrity, courage, and love, things will go as well as they possibly can go.
That is a great approach. I'm certain that as she works through these issues, she will appreciate that guidance.
The other thing is, she asked the question, how to prepare for what's next? And the answer to me is kind of a paradox, which is, I would say to her, stay present. Don't get too far ahead of yourself. Stay present, because that's the place where we are all the most resourceful, is when we are fully in the present.
So when you talk about being resourceful, what does that actually mean to her?
Well, when I'm resourceful, there are different ways of accomplishing that, but I mentioned earlier having some kind of a contemplative practice or a meditation practice or a prayer practice. Those are all ways that help people access their resources, connect with themselves, connect with their body, connect with their breath, find the strength that is within each one of us. And we all have strength even when we're going through difficult times. And the more that we can access our strength and our wisdom and remember the people who love us and the people that we love, all of those things help us feel more resourceful, which allows us to better deal with whatever challenge arises.
That's terrific. Excellent, excellent mentoring and coaching from that perspective. I appreciate that, and I'm certain that Sandy will as well.
I hope it's helpful for her.
Good stuff. So yeah. You and Hannah appear to keep a pretty active schedule hosting retreats. You also maintain what looks to be a busy writing schedule with 4 books available on Amazon. What should our listeners be watching from you in the future, and how should they connect with you?
Well, the best way to connect is through our website, which is liveconscious.com. But people are also welcome to send me emails, and the best way to do that is jake@liveconscious.com. Any email I get, I respond personally, and the responses are always confidential. I don't always get back immediately, but I will always respond within a week or two at the longest. And if it's urgent, I'll do it more quickly. So that's the best way to connect with us. And on our website, we have, I think we have about 300 articles. We have some that are available to be downloaded. We have our Dating, Relating, Mating course. And we're coming out with some new online courses next year, in addition to the live retreats that we put on. And we'll be doing a couple of those in 2018 and again into the future. Eventually, we'll do them in Hawaii because we've moved here. We're looking for a place to hold retreats, but we haven't found one yet.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we do, I do some mentoring via Skype, work with people that way. I find it pretty effective.
Terrific. Yeah. Well, Jake, thank you again for being our guest on the Emotions Matter podcast.
My pleasure. Nice to connect with you, John.
Well, thank you very much for listening. This is John, and I invite you to join us again on the next episode of the Emotions Matter podcast.